This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The title race, are we in procession territory? Liverpool ease past the artist formerly known as Manchester City at the Etihad. Sir Boz Lyon-Jones were great. Salah again, surely a shoo-in for all the awards with another goal and an assist. If anything, the bigger result came at the Emirates on Saturday. You're not winning anything if you're losing at home to West Ham. The race for the top 4/5 might be the most interesting thing going on now. As we all predicted at the start of the season, Marcus Rashford and Marco Asensio are the difference for Villa while Newcastle see off Forest. Was Ashley Young penalised for diving because refs didn't get the chance to VAR the life out of him in the 2010s. And then there's the bottom. Southampton, Leicester and Ipswich all concede 4. They are different levels of bad, but the least bad Ipswich have only won 3 all season. Also today, we'll look at the Champions League and Europa League draws. Luka Modric pings one in. Indulge me on the all-new Cambridge United. There's your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hi, Max.
Hello, Jonathan Wilson.
Morning, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Welcome, Dan Bardell.
Hello.
Let's start the Etihad then. Manchester City 0, Liverpool 2. Liverpool now 20 points ahead of City after this game, 11 points clear at the top of the league. Clearly not a surprising result, Wilson. Surprised at how straightforward it was, if you thought it was straightforward?
No, I didn't think it was straightforward. I mean, you look at the stats and the stats show Liverpool had 34% possession. They had 8 chances to City 16. I think the XG was 0.7 to 0.6 in Liverpool's favour. But once they'd taken the lead after 14 minutes, I don't think anybody would have thought anything other than Liverpool win. And that, I think, is how Liverpool have been this season. Yeah, it's their 7th 2-0 of the season. And I think 2-0s, for a team like Liverpool, it's a scoreline of champions. You win comfortably, you're not under pressure, but you don't overextend yourself. And I think that capacity not to overextend themselves might be why Liverpool haven't suffered the injuries that some teams have, that they're very good at controlling games, controlling their own exertions.
I've spent my whole life thinking 2-0 was a dangerous scoreline, and here we are. It's the scoreline of champions. And did you like how they set up with kind of Subbers, Lyon, Jones? I like the graphic saying, you know, it was 4-2-4. It made me very nostalgic, but clearly it wasn't that.
Yeah, I did. Well, it intrigued me. It's a bit of a blow to Darwin Nunez. I think Gary Neville said in the commentary, and I sort of thought it as well, that maybe this is a game to release Nunez, that because City pushed so high, yeah, he is very good at running in behind, even if he's not very good at taking the chances once he gets there. And he does charge about and win the ball back and put defenders under pressure. And City, I think, are susceptible to that. But yeah, you can't deny that the way they played, that sort of 4-2-4-0 did really work. And the fact that Diaz started on the left, moved in the middle, went back to the left. Yeah, I think it took City a long time to work out what was going on. Szoboszlai was very involved. He deserved his goal, could easily got another couple. So yeah, it absolutely did work.
I enjoyed the first goal, Dan. Nice set-piece move. Arne Slot afterwards was sort of hid the identity of the set-piece coach, so he wouldn't be piled on. Like, it's the next level, you know. It's sort of like, Larry David buys the hospital wing, but he puts his name on it. And the other one next door is the anonymous one, and everyone thinks Larry David's an arsehole. And clearly Austin McPhee and Nicholas Jova in that spot now, the secret set-piece coach, but did a wonderful job on this one.
It's kind of like a weird Banksy thing. If there was to be a mural, no one would know who he is. I don't know where I'm going with that, but that was the first thing that popped into my head. I read after the game that actually Liverpool haven't been very prolific from set pieces at all this season. When you think about the power of Van Dijk and Konate and some of the players that Liverpool have to deliver the football, quite surprising that they haven't been too involved in set piece goals. But I thought it was a wonderfully constructed move, the lovely flick around the corner to Salah, and even when Salah doesn't connect properly, it takes a deflection and still goes in. It's just the way it's going for him at the moment. Pretty much everything he hits goes in, and Salah getting a goal and assist in a game, as you said at the top, is just normal now. 2-0, from what Jonathan says, is quite normal, and it's quite normal that Salah will get the goal and the assist in the game. But set pieces being so important, and we end up talking about them every week on stuff like this, it is quite interesting. Actually, Liverpool have just relied on being a good football team rather than set pieces, whereas it feels like a lot of teams are actually quite reliant on set pieces, and it's Liverpool that are running away with the league.
Meanwhile, Barry, Man City are not relying on being a good football team at the moment.
No, they're not. I think before we talk about City, I think Liverpool must be commended on emerging from the mid-season slump everyone was writing and talking about last week, which comprised of them beating Wolves and drawing two very difficult games away from home. So it's good that they've put that behind them. But, yeah, I mean, Wilson kind of summed it up there. City had well over 60% possession, but never really looked that threatening. Their wingers, Jeremy Doku, I can't decide whether he had a good game or not. He completed more dribbles than anyone else in the Premier League this season, but there was very little in the way of end product. Over on the other side, what's your man, Savino? He seemed to run into traffic any time he got the ball. And City just could not break Liverpool down. You know, just watching the game live, and then Troy Deeney and Joe Hart sort of analysed it quite well on Match of the Day, just showing that there was this constant red wall in front of City's players. And Kevin De Bruyne, who is normally tasked with, you know, picking the locks of those doors, he's just not playing well at the moment, and the drop-off and the decline in his performances has been a bit sad to see, I have to say, because I'm a huge fan of his and he's one of the best players, I think, that's ever graced the Premier League, but it looks like his best days might be behind him. And City didn't really have any opportunities of note. It was an extremely comfortable day at the office for Liverpool. Virgil van Dijk and Ibrahim Konate barely broke sweat, and it was easy for them.
Yeah, I suppose from the City point of view, Wilson, I guess there are a couple of things, right? We're waiting on the charges and what happens with those, but also starting to talk about the rebuild and how big it is. Sometimes you can bring in one or two players and actually transform a team, right? And I just don't know if that is the case with City, or if there are if the problems are deeper than that.
I mean, I think it does need a pretty much wholesale rebuild, but it doesn't mean you have to do it in one go, and you probably shouldn't do it in one go. And to be honest, I'd argue that four players in January is too many. Now, it doesn't look like Reyes is going to play. So, okay, it's three plus one. Kasanov looks not quite ready for this level yet, but I guess maybe it's good to get him up to speed, and if he can still finish in the top five, then that's fine. Nico Gonzalez, I was very sceptical of, but I think he's actually done much better than I was expecting. And Marmoush looks like a proper player. So I guess the rest of the season is a case of developing that relationship between Marmoush and Haaland. And you know, Haaland not being there yesterday clearly did make a big difference. But they probably still need three or four others, because people like De Bruyne, I think even Bernardo Silva looks old for his age. It might be, you know, two months off and he comes back refreshed and in a better team, maybe he starts to pick that up again. Yeah, Phil Foden, I think, he's obviously not finished. He's not coming to the end, clearly. But he had a very slow start of the season, and there's only really been flickers since then. You look at how many injuries they have at the back. The fact that John Stones is injured so often now, is that a perpetual state, or can he get back to playing regularly? I mean, he's always been a player who seems to struggle a lot with injuries. Kyle Walker's now left on loan, so that needs dealing with. You know, even Edison, I think, is not quite the goalkeeper he was. So there's questions all over the place. It does need quite a big rebuild. That is quite a lot of work. And if Guardiola if his powers are waning, which I think there's some evidence maybe this season that they are, then that's a big job for him to take on, and it might not be one that he's got the resources to carry out. I mean, you know, even if you take into account the fact he had that year out after his 4 years at Barcelona, this is his 16th season managing at the very highest level. And there's very few other coaches who've done more than 10. So if he is feeling the strain, it's normal, it's natural. Yeah, he's already 5 years older than Johan Cruyff was when he retired.
They can't have 2 months off, because on the 19th of June, they're playing Wydad AC, second in the Moroccan League, in the Club World Cup, which we're all looking forward to. That might be the 18th of June UK time, 19th Australia time. I mean, who knows, but you know. Let's just forget it.
Who cares?
Everybody. Yeah, I think so. Title done then, Dan, isn't it? I mean, and it's a bit annoying that it's this early, but should we hand them the trophy now?
I think if I was a bookmaker, I'd probably start preparing myself to pay up at this point. I think it might have even been over on Saturday come 5 o'clock when Arsenal hadn't won, which obviously we're going to come on to. I think that took away from the game yesterday a little bit. I think there might have been a little bit more jeopardy in that game. I agree with Barry, you know, the Liverpool form had been exaggerated slightly, but had Arsenal won as we all expected them to, and Liverpool had kind of had a stodgy kind of few weeks, it might have made Liverpool a little bit more tense, but as it was, they could just turn up at Manchester City and kind of shift through the gears when they needed to, sit in and, you know, ask Manchester City to break them down once they went ahead, and Manchester City couldn't do that. I just thought it was an easy, easy game. I think Manchester City even looked like scoring, and, you know, for the title race to feel over at the 24th of February, that feels very, very early. I don't remember many title races being over by the 24th of February. I don't know whether anyone else can think of one.
I mean, if Wilson can't, I'm not sure. Oh, well, Nick says, I just want to say a big thank you when you said, Max, on the last pod that you had a feeling the title race was still on. I knew Arsenal would blow it and the Reds would do City. Martin says, is it now possible to just replay Wilson's analysis on Arsenal from the last year without anybody noticing? Before we go to Wilson on Arsenal, Barry, it's the decent thing to say well done to West Ham, and they were brilliant at the Emirates.
Yeah, an awful lot has been made of the fact that Arsenal are missing, you know, four first-choice attacking players. But what hasn't been mentioned much, or I haven't heard it mentioned or seen it mentioned, is that West Ham are also missing four very important attacking players in Lucas Paqueta, Mikel Antonio, and Nicholas Fulkrug, maybe not as important, and Crescencio Somerville. So they were all out. And West Ham just did a number on Arsenal here. Mikel Arteta was obviously very angry with his team's performance, and he did include himself in the collective when he was scathing with his criticism. They got another red card. Miles Lewis-Skelly, I don't think he can have any complaints about this one. And West Ham, I thought, were just superb in defence, superb in attack. Aaron Wan-Bissaka, Jared Bowen, Mohamed Kudus constantly causing Arsenal's defence problems, and they were well worth the win, I think.
Yeah, I liked Kudus sort of showboating 50 minutes in, 1-0 up. Like, feels a bit early. But, you know, it was fine. And, you know, we can add Aaron Wan-Bissaka to players who've left Man United and got good. Might have taken him a little while, but there he is on that list. Look, Dan, injuries do make such a big difference. Like, we've talked about it with other teams relentlessly this season. If you're missing your front three, like, that makes you worse. It doesn't mean you shouldn't find a way of beating West Ham, who weren't on a great run, but you can have sympathy for Arsenal.
Yeah, obviously Jesus is out as well, so essentially they're missing their best four attacking players. That will affect any team. That will make a difference. You look at Manchester City yesterday, one attacking player missing, and how it affected them not having a focal point. So obviously it is going to play a part. And I think it's almost worse for Arsenal, because whenever they don't win a game or whenever they don't score a goal, the dialogue is going to turn to, why haven't they bought a striker for the last X amount of transfer windows? I thought it was an interesting call to go with Marino as the centre-forward in this one. Obviously, it worked well towards the end of the game when he came on as an impact player against Leicester. But I think from the start, I didn't think that was something that was ever going to work, because when the game opened up against Leicester and they're kind of playing in transition, Marino is going to find himself making runs from similar areas than he would do from midfield. So arriving kind of late into the box and being that centre forward. And that worked late on in the Leicester game. When you're playing from the start in a game where you're probably going to have a lot of possession, you're asking him to be the focal point. I think that's a very different thing, and I didn't expect that to work, and I was surprised Arteta went for it, and Arsenal didn't score ultimately, so questions are going to be asked. But you're right to kind of point out that they should have enough on the pitch to cause West Ham a few more problems. I think that was the thing. I didn't even really feel like Arsenal caused problems. It wasn't like they were getting down the wing or crossing the ball in or creating chances, and there was chances being missed. There was just nothing really happening, and I've watched Odegaard quite a lot this season, and I know he had an injury at the start of the season, but I actually don't think he's been that good at all this season. I would have expected a player like that, the captain, the kind of number 10, one of the star players, to shoulder a bit more of the burden and take more responsibility. And I think whilst players have been out, I don't actually think Odegaard's done that at all.
Michael says, with the amount of red cards Arsenal have received this season, should Mikel Arteta focus a little less on the dark arts and a bit more on the light arts? I mean, that plays into, Wilson, your sort of Arsenal Is it now a theorem? Has it been proved?
I remember Arsenal fans being very upset. I was never very clear what it was they were upset about. I mean, they've had 5 red cards this season. One of them has been overturned. I think they were very lucky it was overturned. I think the Lewis Skelly foul at Wolves on Matt Doherty was so late, it's violent conduct, not just a cynical foul. So I thought they were really lucky to get away with that. Anyway, that's not relevant now. But they've dropped 10 points in those 5 games. If they got those 10 points, they'd be a point behind Liverpool with a game in hand. So that's their own ill-discipline has cost them. And, yeah, Arsenal fans will whine, oh, you know, nobody else ever gets players sent off to getting a second yellow kicking the ball away. Yeah, there's 2 really easy ways to avoid getting a second yellow by kicking the ball away. Number one, don't get a first yellow. Number two, don't kick the ball away. So that's just on them, just not learning. And just, you know, being kind of just stupid. But they also, they just seem a team, a club, where they get down on themselves very quickly. Whenever there's hardship, rather than saying, how do we get over this? We just go, oh, well, it's hard. What can we do? Like, if you lose your four best forwards, it makes life tougher. Clearly it does. But what you then have to do is say, right, how are we going to set about winning games when we don't have our 4 best forwards? And again, you might like to turn the clock back and think, we probably should have signed a forward either in the summer or the previous summer. Did we really need Calafiori and Marino? Good players as they are, but was that really the priority? That would be a question you should ask yourself. If you are eventually, as they did, deciding to relieve some of the burden on Saka, who's been grotesquely overplayed for 4 years now, then was Sterling really the player to come in to do that? And you'd have to say that was a bad decision as well. So those 2 decisions are on them. Irrespective of the bad luck, they've put themselves in a position where that bad luck could hurt them. But then, how do you win a game when you haven't got a forward? Or haven't got a forward you trust? You keep it tight. You're really good at set plays. All right, Saka is one of the reasons why you're good at set plays, because of his delivery. But Declan Rice is a good deliverer of the ball. Keep it tight. Try and score from a set play. And then you hope that in the way that Christopher Ray got them through games in 97-8, that Marino can step up or somebody else can step up. And you look to win games 1-0. But I think Dan's right. I think they went far too early with Marino. What should be an option off the bench, what should be an interesting, how do we turn this in the last 20, 30 minutes with the score at 0-0, became a strategy from the start. They looked flat for me off, and they're just not a team you trust to, as soon as a hurdle is put in front of them, they trip over it. Now, it might be I've been unlucky with the Arsenal games I've been to this season, but should have beaten Fulham away, drew, just you ran out of ideas. Drew at home to Sean Dyche's Everton, 0-0, when they ran out of ideas. 2-0 up against Villa, and I just had 8 ridiculous minutes in the second half where they conceded twice and Tielemans hit the post, so they could easily have lost that game. They've let so many soft points. The game away at Brighton, okay, they get a slightly odd penalty given against them, but they just don't respond to it. They sort of, as soon as there's adversity, it's just, oh, what can we do? And, you know, it really wouldn't have taken much for still to be in this title race. They, you know, I've just talked there, the red cards, those games. That's what, 16, 18 points. They've just given up. Not because they were the worst team, because they just were too careless, because they didn't have the hard edge that champions need, that Liverpool have.
Could you believe, Jonathan, that the end of the game, they have free kick in a dangerous position, and Raheem Sterling is sent up to take that free kick? And it was just one of the strangest things I've ever seen, because he's so devoid of confidence, so devoid of form. I can't recall him ever scoring a free kick, maybe one in the past. Again, I've come back to Ødegaard. Where's Ødegaard? I think he was on the pitch when this happened. Like,
I think he was standing next to it. It was like, it was, who's going to take it? Yeah.
I just can't understand why, you know, in the game state as is, why you would send Raheem Sterling to take that free kick. It doesn't make any sense to me.
I was talking to Perry Groves in Talksport Towers yesterday, and he couldn't get
massive
over the fact.
Name drop.
Oh, yeah.
Pick that name off the floor.
Arsenal legend Perry Groves. Normally we discuss antiques when we meet, but he wasn't interested in talking about antiques, because he wanted to discuss the fact that Ricardo Calafiori didn't just foul Aaron Wan-Bissaka in the build-up to the goal. Why didn't he foul him? He couldn't understand it. Why did he let him come in and cross the ball? I think he also mentioned, you know, and Jonathan has mentioned, you know, try and score from set pieces. Now, Declan Rice didn't play particularly well on Saturday, but why take him off before the hour mark when he's your best corner taker? Because Zinchenko came on for him and didn't do much, you know, wasn't any better. but at least Rice can take a good corner. So just weird decision making, but anyway.
I think the manager filters into that a little bit as well. Like, he's such a control freak as a manager. But I do feel that when a game is getting away from Arsenal, it's not going the way that he thought it was going to go. He does try a lot of strange things that are very scattergunned. Zinchenko coming off of Declan Rice makes no sense for the reasons that you just said, Barry. But they've done that in a few games. I've seen games where they've been behind or they've been drawing. And he couldn't obviously do this at the weekend because they haven't got any attackers. But in previous games, he's just thrown on attacker after attacker and gone away completely from what makes them good and gone away from the shape that they usually play, things that they clearly can't have worked on in training. And I think in this current situation with where they are, yes, the injuries play a part, but I do think they've only got themselves to blame in a lot of ways.
Yeah, look, they are, I mean, it's worth pointing out, the second best team in the league, right? There are 18 teams that are worse than them. But I wonder if pressure begins on Arteta Wilson, or how many years in. Like, he's clearly a good manager. He's clearly turned Arsenal into a really good football team in relative terms, just not good enough to go the next step. They're still in the Champions League. We'll get to the draw in a bit. It's not been that kind to them. But, like, they are close.
Yeah, my criticism wouldn't really be directed at Arteta. I think Arteta, I would probably blame him. I don't know if he started it, but he certainly helped stir it up. After the Newcastle game last season, you know, his complaints about the refereeing. What was the word that he used? He claimed a different meaning in Spanish.
Disgracia.
Disgracia, yeah. That, I thought, was a bad intervention that sort of helped sort of align the club with the conspiracy nonsense online. And I think he has been trying to row back from that. I mean, the Bournemouth game, for instance, when Saliba was sent off, he was very clear afterwards, no, it's a totally justified red card. We can't argue about that. And I think he has tried to be a bit more composed about that kind of thing. And the Brighton penalty, he was pretty upset by. But to an extent, I understand that. Football has this habit of kind of, a manager makes one thing goes wrong and, oh, the manager has to be sacked because he hasn't been perfect. I just don't think that is how the club should approach it. I think Arteta has clearly made Arsenal better. I think things aren't going right at the moment, but nobody's in a better position to understand why they're going wrong and to grasp how to put them right than Arteta. So I think you give them at least one more year. If they fail in the same way next season, then fair enough. But the last two seasons, although they have frittered away silly points. I mean, last season, the West Ham and Fulham games around Christmas particularly, they've got a high points tally and just been beaten by one of the best teams we've ever seen in England. So you can't really blame him for that. This season, I think, is much more culpable, but they have had the injuries.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll do the race for the Champions League spots. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So I guess, Barry, from Nottingham Forest in third on 47 points, if top five is going to get you Champions League, which we coefficient-wise looks like it will at the moment, how far do you go down the table to say they've got a shout?
Go down to Brentford in 11th. I think they have a shout. There's 7 points between them and Newcastle in fifth. And I think the way Brentford are playing, I would give them a more than sporting chance of making the top five.
Yeah, let's start with that game at St James's Park. Sort of weird 4-3, Dan. Rangecross Soft says, what do you think Eddie Howe said at half-time to turn his brilliant team into total crap? Because it wasn't like they're obviously, like, there's something about Newcastle at St James's Park where they can just blow a team away in 10 minutes. But it wasn't like they just shut up shop in a sort of Liverpool way. They just had a terrible second half. And I was listening to someone after the game saying, actually, sort of fans left a bit frustrated, even though they'd won a really, really vital game.
Yeah, it was such a bizarre game. Obviously, when Forest go ahead, you kind of fear for Newcastle a little bit, because generally through the season, we've talked about how good Forest are defensively, how good the goalkeeper is, the centre-back pairing's very good. But actually, over the last month or so, they've let a few games get away from them, Forest. And when they have conceded, and Newcastle obviously equalised very, very quickly, the goals have come in gluts. It happened at Bournemouth a month or so ago, three weeks ago when that happened. And it happened again at St James's Park, which I think is a worrying trend for Forest. And Newcastle did very well. Obviously, when you've got one of the best centre forwards there is, it's going to help. And I thought Isak was so good in that first half and so dangerous. One of the most bizarre penalties as well that I think I've ever seen. I'm still trying to work out what happened with that penalty. Was it a Panenka? Wasn't it a Panenka? Should Sells have actually saved it when he didn't go down? I can't work that one out.
No, I think he's really unlucky because it sort of would have been better if he just dived, because then none of us would say anything, sort of think anything, because he's sort of close and you know he's got no weight to push. He's turns, he's as weak as a kitten. There's just nothing there to hit the ball. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, and Newcastle took their foot off the gas, I think, in the second half. It wasn't a collapse, but if there had been any form of stoppage time, you'd have wagered that Newcastle might have been in trouble there. We'd already had the game after that was coming up ruined a little bit. For there to only be 3 minutes of stoppage time was absolutely disgusting with a game set at 4-3. I was hugely disappointed by that. You don't often see 3 minutes.
Well, you wanted 10. Yeah. You wanted 10.
I think for now, four is the minimum, isn't it, that you expect in a football match. To only have three, it completely ruined the end of the game for me. But whatever's happened, Newcastle, that is a huge result, because that was a big game with Forest being where they are and Newcastle being in and amongst it where they are. You do kind of get the impression that Forest may tumble down a little bit and Newcastle may rise up, depending on how the Carabao Cup affects them.
Yeah, interesting. Lewis Miley came in for Tonali Barry and actually had a brilliant game.
Yeah, like he looks about 13 years old, but it was a very mature performance from him. I'd kind of forgotten about him. I'd forgotten he was there, and I think it was his first start for a year, but he looked really calm and composed on the ball, very willing runner, good at popping passes around, and obviously he's a local lad and a Newcastle fan, so going to be a crowd favourite there. And yeah, this was a weird game. Eddie Howe didn't really know what to make of it afterwards. He was pleased they won. He was very angry with the second half. I think it was a capitulation, because Forrest scored two. They missed three good chances. Anthony Elanga had a miss where he tried to sort of hook it in with his foot when he should have headed it. Murillo had a thumping header at a corner that he somehow put wide. Then there was Morgan Gibbs-White. I think it was a cross, but with him you can't be sure, that Nick Pope had to palm over the bar. So Forrest did have the chances to get more than three, and on another day they could have done that, and the Newcastle crowd would have left very frustrated and angry. But they got away with it.
Alexander Isak, the first Swedish player to get 50 goals in the Premier League. Lundberg is on 48. I mean, I say is. He's unlikely to add to that. to add to that, Telly. Seb Larsson, 26. Kulusevski, 22. And Johan Elmander, 19. He's not the highest scoring Scandinavian. He's in fifth place with that. Can anyone name the top four?
Haaland.
Yes. Haaland's second.
Second? Do Iceland doesn't count as Scandinavia, does it? Or does it?
Iceland doesn't count.
Great question, this.
I mean, John Dal Thomason didn't score any goals, did he?
That was who just popped into my head.
It can't be him.
Right. The chef from the Muppet
John
Show.
Dal Thomason. No.
So there's no other Swedes?
He'd be in the Swedish list, wouldn't he?
Solskjaer. Must be top.
He's number one. And then you've got Haaland, and then you've got a Dane and a Norwegian ahead of him.
Ivan Lien Ertsen?
Egil Ostenstad?
No. The Dane is a midfielder.
Fjortoft?
No.
And Mbeumo? No, he's a Cameroon. No, he's Cameroonian. Honestly, I've gone all over the place there.
Cameroon. Not in Scandinavia. Famously not in Scandinavia.
Ericsson.
Ericsson, yeah. In fourth place, Josh King. So obviously he wouldn't have got for ages. I enjoyed that quiz. To Villa Park, Villa 2, Chelsea 1. I mean, look, we were on the radio yesterday, Dan, but it is worth reiterating. If at the start of the season, you know, someone had just said to you, yeah, you'll beat Chelsea and Marcus Rashford will set up two for Marco Asensio, you wouldn't have gone, yeah, of course, that's going to happen.
Yeah, like, absolute madness. I said yesterday as well that even if you'd have told me probably midway through January that was going to happen, I wouldn't have felt that was on the cards, because Rashford looked like he may go abroad to try and resurrect his career. Probably worth saying, I've done quite a lot of these podcasts, so I think it's the first time Villa have won when I've done this show. Normally I'll come on and I haven't won, which is a pleasant feeling and a nice change. Second half, Rashford just completely changed that game. It wasn't necessarily, you know, Rashford providing assists for Asensio that Villa planned when they made these transfers, but just watching these two high quality, high level players on the pitch, Rashford's come in, and considering the kind of amount of time he hasn't played any football for, he's looked sharp from the get-go, whether he's come off the bench or whether he starts like he did against Liverpool on Wednesday night. He's looked really, really sharp, and by the sounds of things, he's done everything that's been asked of him behind the scenes. And when you watch him as well, he's probably doing everything I would expect someone playing in that position to do as well from the left-hand side. Villa have kind of flipped their system a little bit to accommodate Rashford. So normally the width comes from the player playing on the right wing, but now they've flipped it so the width is coming from the player on the left wing, and the fullback's not coming forward as much, the player that normally creates the width. So Villa have accommodated him quite well when he's on the pitch, and he looks happy, and he looks like he's enjoying his football, and he's so direct, and he's really, really exciting to watch a player with that raw pace and power, playing with a little bit of freedom and playing with a little bit of confidence. And you do get the feeling that Unai Emery has just made so many players at Villa better, players that have been there for a number of years and were perhaps toiling, that he can put his arm around Rashford and he can perhaps do the same. Because one thing Emery is, he's an excellent coach, and he's excellent at getting his ideas across. There's no excuses at Villa, that they're very well prepped for every game, and he came on and Villa won that game because Marcus Rashford came onto the pitch.
And Asensio, Wilson, I suppose, what are your fears about Asensio coming into the Premier League? The only one would be that sort of cliche about the physicality of it, because he's such a delightful footballer, and I don't think necessarily we should be worried about that.
No, I mean, there's been no signs of that. You know, his movement is so good, his touch is so good. Yeah, I think he's been excellent. It probably helps him as well that Rashford's there, that he's not under the radar, but neither is he sort of getting the full glare of publicity. So, and the two of them seem already to have a very good understanding and relationship.
Evan says, should Chelsea buy another 7 keepers since none of this lot are any good? I mean, it was a terrible mistake from Jorgensen, wasn't it, Baz?
Yeah, Villa got lucky with that. He shouldn't have let it in, but it makes up for the penalty they didn't get for the Cucurella foul on Lamar Bogart, I suppose, earlier when it was still 1-1. Much has been made of the fact Chelsea don't have a decent goalkeeper. I think they do have one. He plays for Bournemouth. But I am aware he didn't pull up too many trees when he was in goal for Chelsea. But maybe he'll get a recall and a start next season. I don't know. But yeah, that was a very unfortunate error for Jorgensen. I always feel sorry for keepers when they drop clangers like that. But, you know, such a, it's the life they have chosen.
Yeah, you're right. Everton 2, Manchester United 2. Craig says, how did Everton win 2-2 last week but lose 2-2 this week? Should we start with the last-minute penalty? I sort of mentioned it in the intro, Wilson. Do you think Ashley Young, because he's kind of like after Klinsmann, he sort of feels like the English OG diver, or maybe that's Michael Owen, I don't know, but the ref's got nostalgic? Because he does really, when you first see it, you think, I thought that's a massive dive. Like, he's absolutely flung himself to the floor. And then the big controversy is that VAR didn't show the ref the angle where you can see him being fouled by lots of Manchester United players.
Well, look, he has dived, that is true, but also his shirt has been pulled twice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd entirely be in favour of that being a penalty and the yellow card, which I think would have been the second, so it would have been a red card. That, I think, is a legitimate thing to do.
I agree.
But equally, I almost think, in the way VAR is these days, you sort of... it's incumbent on a player to make obvious that a thing has happened. And so you think of the counterexample of that, which would be, say, Evan Ferguson, the two games for Ireland, one against Finland, one against England, where he was fouled both times in the box and sort of just picked himself up and dusted himself down and got on with it. Whereas you suspect, had he stayed down, had he demanded treatment, had he given the VAR time to check it, he would have got a penalty on both occasions. So that's another unintended consequence of VAR that's very negative, that it really encourages players to sort of make sure that any contact is very, very visible. But yeah, I just don't, I can't, especially once the penalty's been given, I can't grasp how that's overturned. And I think, as far as possible, I try and avoid talking about referees and VAR, but I think this was a terrible weekend for VAR. You know, I think the Cucurella foul on Bogard, but also the Zabani red card at Bournemouth, I think, was a terrible decision.
Well, I thought that was a red.
Well, Do you want to talk about it now? Or do you want to wait?
We can wait.
That's something okay. to look forward to.
Yeah, isn't it? That's just a tease.
There was a really bad penalty not given in the Leicester-Brentford game as well. Yeah, three really bad penalty decisions. But this was the most egregious because the ref gave it and then overturned his own perfectly correct decision.
Yeah. And this is another example. I mean, obviously players do this anyway, but, you know, it encourages even more sort of primary school. Look what he did running up. Look what he did, you know, TV monitor. Look what he did. David says, can I please request most of the coverage of Everton United to be upon the amazing Helms deep head tennis of Beto's goal? It was, Barry. I watched this so many times. I counted all the headers. I just loved every second. And for it to end with an air kick, then a miss hit. It just had everything, this goal.
I don't think it was a miss hit, but we'll agree to disagree on that. Yeah, corner comes in, seven different headers, five of them by United players, none of whom headed it away from danger. Then the miss hit by Doucouré and Beto. I think he meant to hit it into the ground. But, you know, whether he did or he didn't, he scored anyway. That's, what, 5-4 for him, or 4-3, whatever. He's clearly very confident. He helped set up the Doucouré goal. And I thought Doucouré, Drissa Ganagay were brilliant in this game. And United were unspeakably bad for 72 minutes, like as bad as they've been this season. And they've plumbed some depth.
That is a low bar.
I think Everton sort of blunderbuss themselves in the foot by... Well, the free kick came on the back of another free kick, which I don't think should have been given for a non-foul on Garnacho. But anyway, it was given. Gaping hole in the defensive wall, which Bruno Fernandes stepped up, thanks very much. And that kind of flicked the switch for United. And Everton were clinging on at the end, but then they got this penalty, which was subsequently not given. So I think Everton... We're very unlucky not to take all 3 points, but they are slightly culpable.
Mm. I mean, it's a good hit from Ugarte. Yes, Dan?
I was going to say, what I've liked about this game is that, you know, sometimes when a team comes back from 2-0 down, they come back to 2-2 and everyone talks about the fight and the spirit and, you know, what a great bunch of lads and things like that. There's been none of that at Manchester United coming back from 2-0 down. I think everyone just pretty much agrees that they're still absolutely hopeless, even the Manchester United fans. So I quite enjoyed that, even though they've done well to get back to 2-2. It's just not been celebrated at all by anyone.
I mean, I think fans are already worried about Amrin Wilson and how little has changed. Or in fact, they've got worse. But you know, I still don't know if, you know, like, clearly there is so much wrong. You hope that he is given, I don't know. It's hard because you sort of need to give somebody years, but you need to give the right person years. And maybe it can never be fixed.
Yeah, I mean, that is the problem. That it is a little bit like, you know, you set Hercules to work cleaning the Augean stables, and then 10 minutes later you pop your head around the door and go, oh, still looks quite dirty, Hercules. And Hercules, yeah, I'm trying to divert these rivers through here, and they're like, all right, okay. Cause the danger is we just end up with a wet, dirty stable rather than just a dirty stable. And the truth is, till he's diverted that river, you just don't know whether that's going to be enough to clean the stable. And that's where United are now. They're in the process of diverting that river.
It was the analogy that I was expecting, certainly. United staff have been warned they could face dismissal, of course, if caught leaking confidential information about the club.
I love the fact that the email warning United staff they could be dismissed for leaking information was leaked.
Yeah, it follows a memo reminding employees of their obligations under data protection and confidentiality agreements. The warning comes amid concerns over internal details being shared with the media as new co-owner Sir Jim Ratcliffe aims to tighten operations behind the scenes. I mean, I don't know if he's yet to say, send me 5 things you did last week. But, you know, he's not far away. I mean, apart from he may have fired all the people that he wanted to get that email from anyway. All sounds fun and nice, doesn't it, up at Old Trafford at the moment. To Portman Road, Ipswich won Spurs 4, Spurs' third consecutive league victory. They haven't managed that since December 2023. Wilson, you were there. Did you have a nice time?
Yeah, I did. It's a nice setup at Ipswich. Food was good. Pretty decent working facilities. Everybody's very friendly. And Ipswich are quite good going forward, but absolutely terrible at the back, which I guess you could probably say about Tottenham as well. So yeah. It was
It was all good. I mean, that first 5 minutes was sort of like,
amazing.
Christ, Ipswich going to absolutely batter them here. Yeah, they had three really good chances. Poor Archie Gray, who I think is a great player, but there are occasionally he just doesn't look like a centre back, which is fair enough because he's not. But Liam Delap, you know, ripped him apart that first couple of minutes. But then you know you see his quality on the ball with that. That, you know, he was playing. He and Danso had switched over. So he was playing on the right, Danso on the left. And this was put to Postecoglou afterwards. Was that why you switched them so that Archie Gray could swing those balls out to Son? And I've rarely seen a manager look so surprised. And then go, if you want to give me that credit, that's fine. But I really wasn't thinking of it. So yeah, fair play to Postecoglou for being honest about that. But it was the shape of that pass. I mean, Ipswich made it easy. Ben Godfrey had one of the worst performances you'd ever see from a fullback, and Son looked in favourable circumstances. He looked back to being pretty good again. But Brennan Johnson twice not picked up in the box, and it was just defensively Ipswich were nowhere near good enough, and they're going to get relegated as a result. They're letting in more than two goals a game, and that is not good enough to stay up.
Yeah, I mean, look, it definitely showed, and we've talked about their injuries a lot, but being able to bring on first team players helps, doesn't it? Because your team stays good if you change it in the 60th minute or the 70th minute. Jed Spence, Dan's having a very good time. Took a long time for him to get into the side under Postecoglou. Even thoughts of him sneaking into the England squad, is that a step too far or possible? Sort of seem to remember us having like 25 brilliant right backs, but I'm not sure if that's still the case.
I'd be a bit apprehensive about putting Spurs defenders in the England squad based on such a small sample size as well. They've kind of stumbled upon him, haven't they? Because they've had so many injuries. I think injuries aside, if there'd not been the level of injuries that they had, Jed Spence was nowhere near being a pick for Postecoglou at Tottenham. I did think it was interesting that he was selected at right back ahead of Pedro Porro. I don't know whether Pedro Porro's carrying a knock, but whenever I've watched Tottenham, I've always thought that Porro's one of their better players. So to see him start...
It was just given Porro a rest because he had another rest of 20-odd games. Yeah,
that makes sense then. But because Jed Spence played most of his football this season at left back from what I remember. But he's been given a shirt and done a good job for Tottenham. I just think Vicario makes a huge difference. I think he calms any nerves that are in the Tottenham defence. He's made some good saves since he's come back in the team.
I'm not sure he calms all the nerves. I just like to
say. No, there's still nerves. There's still nerves there, but maybe there's less nerves than when the other goalkeepers have been in goal. I think, you know, they had four goalkeepers in goal at various stages this season, Tottenham in Premier League games. So, you know, to have four keepers playing one season, it's no wonder that things have been a mess. I just don't think that beating Manchester United and Ipswich necessarily proves that Spurs have turned a corner, and the next game is Manchester City at home, and if they beat them, I'm not sure that proves anything either. So the game after that, that's when we'll know whether Spurs are back.
Ashes, last season it wasn't until mid-April, and the season before it was almost May before 16th place hit 30 points. That's been done already this season, pretty much 2 months early. Is it basically game over for promoted teams now, or is this year a mental quirk? Yeah, we'll get to Wolves winning in just a second, but they're now on 22 points, Barry. So you've got Ipswich on 17, Leicester 17, Southampton 9.
Well, Southampton and Leicester are hopeless, absolutely hopeless. Two of the worst teams I've seen in the Premier League. Leicester fans are protesting. They had a big protest last week. They're not happy with the top, the fella who owns the club, and the director of football, who they say never gives them any information. But anyway, that's by the by. They're definitely gone. You would give Ipswich some sort of chance if they could defend, but they can't. So I think it's done. Yeah, the three of them down. And Wolves are conspicuously better than the three of those.
Can I give you some stats?
Please.
So I've looked into this promoted side this year. And I've now got a spreadsheet. This is very exciting for me. I've never really used a spreadsheet before, but when the league went to 20 teams in 96-7, if you take a 5-year rolling average from then of what the promoted sides have got, the first 5 years, so up to 2000, 2001.
Can I just interrupt to say I'm already bored?
Well, no,
he's done the work, Barry. Like, you can't. It's his first spreadsheet. I'm amazed this is your first spreadsheet.
Damn
me. I thought you had spreadsheet after spreadsheet about every single detective show, not necessarily about, you know, about inverted fullbacks, etc. But here we go. It's your first spreadsheet. So, you know, you set yourself free. Yes, Dan?
Can I poo-poo your spreadsheet by saying that they went to 20 teams in 95, 96, not 96, 97?
Well, I've calculated from 96, 7 for whatever
I don't think reason. That makes a difference, but yeah, it was 95, 96, I believe.
Well, now I know it's flawed. I'm even less interested.
you might remember my silent witness spreadsheet, which was never a spreadsheet. I never said spreadsheet. Other people imposed a spreadsheet upon me. Okay. It was a document, but it was not a spreadsheet. Anyway, it's dropped from... In the first 5 years of data I considered, which was up to 2000 to 2001, it's dropped from an average of 41.66 points down to 34.02 at the end of last season. Now, if you look at the three promoted teams this season, they've got a total of 17 plus 17 plus 9 is 43 points. So even assuming that they add a third more to that, you're looking at under 20 points as an average. It was 22 points last season, the average. So that's going to drop way below 34.02. So what I'm saying is it's gone down by an average of 7 points per season in the last 25 years, and it's continuing to fall. So it is getting harder and harder for promoted sides. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. I mean, I think we all knew... I think we didn't need the evidence, but maybe it's good to have evidence in this day and age, you know. What can we do to change that? I mean, because, like, the Premier League is not going to give money down to the EFL, or not as much as they need.
Well, it's not about parachute payments, because we've already got a situation where the three teams in contention for automatic promotion after Sunderland lost again at the weekend are all teams who are benefiting from parachute payments. So there's this sort of mezzanine tier of clubs who are too big for the Championship and too small for the Premier League, and that's a problem.
Should there be a six-team mezzanine below the Premier League?
I'd be in favour of that, yeah. Yeah, they play each other, what, eight times a season? And maybe the top team gets to play off against the bottom of the Premier League, and the bottom team plays off against the top of the Championship.
Who has the rights? Does Sky have the rights to the mezzanine, or someone else has the mezzanine rights? I don't know.
A few seasons ago, Bournemouth, Fulham, and was it Brentford? I can't remember. I don't think it was Brentford, actually. Bournemouth, Fulham, and the other newly promoted team. They all stayed up, didn't they? What was different then, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that is only the season before last. Yeah. That is true. I mean, what is different there is that Forest massively breached FFP regulations.
Worth the risk, though. Worth the risk.
Yeah, well, but I genuinely think that might be the best way to do it, is to say, you know what, we're probably going to go down unless we accept a sort of... We got more chance of staying up by taking a four-point penalty and breaching the regulations than by trying to do it and staying within the boundaries.
Interesting. All right. That'll do for part two. Part three, we'll begin at the Vitality. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Look, good win for Wolves. Luke says, am I imagining it? Or did you preview Bournemouth Wolves on Thursday by swiftly saying, and Bournemouth will win against Wolves? I did. And more fool me. And look, Wolves do look like they've improved under Pereira, Barry.
They do, yeah. I think the uncertainty around Matheus Cunha's future didn't really help. They have had disciplinary issues as well, but they were really good in this game. They deserved their win. They scored one, they missed two good chances. Pedro Lima and Menezzi missed an absolute sitter. I still don't know how he managed to put that glaring opportunity wide. I think the ball might have hit his standing leg. He miskicked and it hit his standing leg and went wide. But well worth a win against away at a very good Bournemouth side. Wilson alluded to the red card there. I thought it was unlucky, but justified, because intent isn't a factor. Jonathan clearly disagrees. So over to you, Jonathan.
So had the ref sent him off on the field, I don't really have a problem with it. But I think particularly with that type of foul, the ref in real time has a much better sense of whether he's just stretching for the ball and because his foot flicks the top of the ball, that's why he hits the shin, or whether it is really a dangerous lunge. And so I thought the point that Raiola made afterwards was correct, that you slow it down, it looks terrible because the studs go into the shin. And the foot skimming off the top of the ball is not really an excuse if there's a real sort of aggressive intent. But it's not going straight towards the player, it's coming in sideways.
And I just didn't think there was that much force behind it. I thought it was a bit like the one Calvert-Lewin got overturned on appeal in the Cup last season, was it? Against Palace, was that game? I just don't think if you hit a player mid-shin and there's not really any force in it, that should be an automatic red. So look, it's not a ghastly decision. I just don't like the overturning of something where I think the referee on the field probably has a better sense than somebody watching in a box.
It's all about the angles now, isn't it? It's like VAR is supposed to eliminate these kind of debates and this kind of discussion, but we're now at the point where people are debating that the angle that the referee is shown and the angle of the footage, because some angles look like it is a red card, some angles look like it isn't. The same with the penalty in the Everton game. It's all just, I feel like it's just gone too far and it makes football a bit more rubbish.
But that's also why the argument of, they should make the decision within a minute or whatever.
It's like countdown. It'd be panic stations.
Yeah, you have to view every angle because some angles show you a different thing. I mean, that's why the Everton game, I just don't understand. Why would you not show him the angle that seems most sort of to show it?
That they hate him. Whoever that ref is, they just hate that guy. I mean, Urayola saying from all these angles it wasn't a red, from this angle it was, made me think, well, then it is still a red card. We've found the angle that shows it is. But we can agree to disagree. Palace won 2-0 at Fulham. I think my favourite bit of this game, Baz, was Mateta's, I mean, extraordinary feat. Not just good feat for a big man, but like, what's better than good? Great feat for a big man when he slalomed past all those players in the lead up to the second goal.
Yeah, because it was kind of a marauding run, but also a very, you know,
jinky.
Some soft shoe shuffling in there as well, twinkle toes, and great delivery, and the finish was superb. Calvin Bassey might want to have a look at the mirror. He got sent skittering in the wrong direction by, Daniel Munoz, is it? So, yeah, lovely finish from him, and I must confess, I didn't think Palace would win this game, but it's a good win for them. And I mean, what, they didn't win any of their first nine. People were questioning Oliver Glasner, but he's certainly getting a tune out of them now. And I think the resurgence of Will Hughes, because he always seemed to be just on the fringes there at Palace. I don't know if it was because of injuries or lack of form or just because there were better options, but he's really established himself as a crucial player in that Palace lineup.
And Eze had a fun game, did that lovely back heel for a goal that was offside. And there was that bit where he was just standing there with Joachim Andersen, his former teammate, and like just sort of standing still and sort of like a bit like the Simpsons football. And Andersen actually just like put his finger to his wrist like, look, come on. Can we get on with this? It's quite funny. Two games to go. Southampton 0, Brighton 4, and Leicester 0, Brentford 4. We've talked about the two sides at the bottom of the league. So I suppose we can focus on Brighton and Brentford. Which one do you want to take, Dan?
I'll take Brentford because I watched 90 minutes of that game on Friday night, despite saying in the WhatsApp group that I wasn't going to watch it and it wasn't something that I was interested in. I did watch it and actually really enjoyed the game. I thought Brentford were brilliant, but Leicester are just so easy to dispatch now. I think this makes no sense given the points total in the Premier League, but I actually think Leicester might be worse than Southampton. I know that makes no sense given the points totals, but Leicester are just absolutely horrific. And I was watching Wout Faes, who was not very good the last time that Leicester were in the Premier League. I think by the end of the game, he just got fed up of being rubbish and just thought, I'm just going to start fouling everyone. He remember playing fouling football as a kid. He felt like Wout Faes just turned into that. Leicester, honestly, they are hopeless and they're going to get completely what they deserve and get relegated this season because they've got a lot of the players that took them down last time, such as Wout Faes. But then the good ones that were there then aren't there anymore and have been replaced by worse. So it's not really a surprise to see Leicester getting steamrolled by a good Premier League side like Brentford. I just thought that was one of the most abject performances I've seen all season from anyone. Leicester are hopeless.
How do you think Wout Faes played? I didn't quite catch it from that review.
Not very good. Max. Probably about as he did about as well as I did with geography earlier on in the show.
Yeah. Poor bloke. And what about Brighton, Buzz?
Yeah, well, Brighton had, it was comfortable, a 4-0 win over Southampton, as you'd expect. They probably should have scored more. And I think Southampton's manager basically summed up the game when afterwards he said there was an incredible difference between two teams. A disaster, awful game, and we play really bad. I'm not sure what else I can add to that. We know Brighton are good. We know they are capable of the occasional horror show. But, they just swatted Southampton aside, as you would expect them to. Jack Hinshelwood was very good. He's a Brighton lad. And I don't think there's much you can read into this game because Southampton are terrible. Rishi Sunak was the subject of a match of the day cutaway in this game. So it's not the first sinking ship he's watched go down.
The Champions League draw was made on Thursday. Liverpool PSG is one of quite a few highlights. Real Madrid Atleti as well. Bayern Munich by Leverkusen. It's a great game. Arsenal play PSV. They will then play the winners of the Madrid derby. Villa play Club Brugge and then play the winners of Liverpool PSG. So I think, Barry, it looks like a great last 16.
Well, the last 16 is always great. I like the Villa Club Brugge draw.
I don't.
Because I think that's a game both teams will be very confident of winning. Hopefully Villa can get past them. But the last 16 of the Champions League is always good, always, and this is unlikely to be an exception. Arsenal, that's a toughie they've got, and Liverpool as well. I kind of fancy PSG this year, but obviously they've got Liverpool. And
they've got previous.
That will be... I like this incarnation of PSG.
Got some young kids, haven't they? How do you see it, Wilson?
Yeah, I mean, if Tyrone Mings hadn't picked up the ball in the game against Club Brugge in the group stage, Villa would have been playing Bayern again. So maybe picking up the ball was the right thing to do. But the thing that disappoints me or frustrates me a bit is how many of these games have already happened this season, whether domestically or in the group stage. And that feels like a bit of a flaw of the format that we're getting the same again. But yeah, I mean, there's four or five really... intriguing, enticing ties. I think I'm going to the Villa Brugge game at Villa Park, so looking forward to that. I've been to Villa Park for ages.
Go for a beer, Jonathan? Should we go out for a beer?
Yeah, afterwards, why not? Yeah, I've never actually met you, have I? No. Despite doing God knows how many shows with you.
I know. If you could bring that spreadsheet with you as well, I would really appreciate it.
It'll be on my laptop, don't worry.
I'd like a hard copy.
A laminated copy. Man United have got Real Sociedad in the Europa League and Spurs have AZ Alkmaar. So, you know, those ties to be played, the week commencing, whatever it is. Brian says, Modric's looked tired, celebrating that thunder bastard of a strike. I thought, absolutely, I don't know if you have seen it or not, but... He scored an absolute world. He brings it down on his chest and then outside of the right foot, just sort of on the volley, hits it in the top right-hand corner. It's a total joy. Michael says, how does Jonathan Wilson rate the last few weeks of Sunderland's season? All but dropped out of the automatics after defeats to Leeds and Hull. Now he seems to be going under the same youth fatigue issues that have played previous seasons in the run into the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, the Leeds game was the first game this season where Sunderland had been clearly second best. You know, previously, there'd just been a sense that they didn't really take the chances and they gave away some soft goals, which is not good either. But Leeds, although they were two late goals, they sort of waved the wave of pressure late on. And I guess once that game was lost, there's a little bit of the impetus gone out of it. The Hull game was not dissimilar to the Watford game, the Plymouth game, that against teams who sit deep against them, this Sunderland just lacks a little bit of spark. And I think... Yeah, Chris Wigg looks quite tired now. It's playoffs and then we see. And I think the worry is the number of players who could conceivably leave at the end of the season if Sunderland don't go up. I mean, Enzo Lefebvre, his loan, there's an obligation to buy if Sunderland go up. But if Sunderland don't go up, I can't. He's too good to hang around. Surely he's too good for the championship.
Yeah, the inaugural year of the mezzanine. Sunderland would be wonderful in that. James says, as a Bristol City fan, can Max tell me how excited we should be about the new Messi, also known as Josh Stokes? Yeah, he scored two for us at home to Stockport. Yes, he'd be the only good player for us all season. He's brilliant. And we won, and so did everyone else at the bottom, which is a bit of a pity. So we're still bottom. But you never know. The small acorns of a great escape are growing. And Dan says, I just wanted to say a quick thank you for taking my mind off an operation this week. Don't worry. This is not a vasectomy email. My dad was operated on. I had to find a way to while away the hours between the operation starting and finishing. I did the natural thing and saved up a few episodes of Football Weekly to see me through. Your voices are always reassuring to me in a moment of uncertainty. Reed Munich-ing myself. They were truly precious to me. So thank you. The operation went well. Fingers crossed for recovery. Great. Delighted to hear it. Also, my wife, who's Italian, has accidentally coined the word shitmanship as a slight misunderstanding of me saying shithousery. Personally, I think shitmanship is a far better word, and I would humbly request that you try and make it catch on. If Philippe could say it a few times, I've no doubt the whole footballing world would adopt it. We'll see what we can do, Dan. But, you know, love to your dad. I'm glad we filled up some hours, as that's sort of the intention of this. And that'll do for today. Thanks, Wilson.
Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Barry.
Thank you.
Football Weekly is produced by Silas Gray. Our executive producer is Phil Maynard. We'll be back on Wednesday.
This is The Guardian.